welcome to another conversation between myself and Todd Lewis. Today we're going to be talking about the feng shui of economics. Now, I know a previous iteration of me, let's say me from 6 years ago, would have taken a look at a title like that and been like, what on earth? There's only one economics, etc. However, you're a very interesting guy, Todd, so I'm willing to hear you out here with basic, what your kind of basic premise is. Before we get going, I'll just remind people, I pick up some courses from the academic agency. On that front, at the end, there is also courses available at the University of Buckingham, and I will play a clip from Eric Kaufman towards the end of this video. But Todd, and obviously you can find Todd on YouTube. I've linked him down in the show notes. You sent me a title called The Feng Shui of Economics, Technocracy as Meta-Economics. Now I can tell you that this video is not going to be called that because I know how YouTube works and I want more than like five people to watch it. I'll have to come up with some kind of slop-friendly title for it. But what the feng shui of economics? Explain. What is all this about?
All right. So let's start from a very basic principle. All modern society claims to be scientific, and yet one of the things that we never actually see are intentionally constructed human social institutions that are in line with our understanding of science and physics. So let's start with an example, right? One of the people who watch me know that I talk about EROIs a lot, energy return on investment, the idea that if the EROI is less than greater than one, you don't have a physical process. Okay, in a biological system, that means death. So economics, are they physical processes? Absolutely. Every form of economics we've ever had, whether it's been slavery, feudalism, capitalism, socialism, fascism, has all been built on a thermodynamic framework where if the EROI falls below greater than one, it stops working. So ultimately, all economic systems are successful insofar as they are thermodynamically efficient. The problem is, heretofore, no economic system has been intentionally constructed on that principle. There was one attempt, and it was discredited early on in the 20th century. So from like 1919 to 1940, in the United States, there was what was called the technocracy movement. From when we actually get the term technocracy, which didn't at the time have the negative connotations it does now, those who are familiar with Peak Oil and Hubbard was one of the founders of the technocracy movement, as well as Howard Scott. And the idea was that you could have an economic system intentionally built on these principles of thermodynamics. So instead of cash exchange, they speculated about certificates denominated in joules, where you measure the entire energy within the productive system, which for their level of precision was the continent of North America. And the idea would be that, okay, well, we're going to build an economic system that is efficient, that is based on these principles of measuring energy flows when they saw capitalism as inefficient for lots of reasons, planned obsolescence, the problem of overproduction, the idea that, so for example, if we look at land transportation in the United States or anywhere in the world, rail is the most efficient from energy in, energy out. Everybody knows rail is the most efficient. But after World War II, the U.S. built a automobile truck industry for transportation. Why? Well, that was financial reasons. That wasn't done for efficiency reasons, because efficiency reasons would have dictated railroads. And so basically, why is feng shui? Feng shui is the idea from ancient China that you should live according to the energy flows latent in the universe, which they call qi. And so this is a sort of poetic expression of what we can now measure scientifically through our understanding of energy flows. And the feng shui of economics, technocracy as meta-economics, is saying that the technocracy movement, the energy-based economics movement, is the scientific representation of this more poetic, mythic way of describing it, and that the economy that we have now is not like this, right? It's not self. It is informed by thermodynamics. It does have to take that into account, but that's not where you start when you build a market. Whereas you just end up having this wasted conversion variable. So let's imagine you have a schoolboy that knows, you know, imperial and metric, and he has to keep converting between the two. Well, that's inefficient. Why don't you just pick one, like the rest of the world, imperial or metric, and then you just keep that. But you see, with capitalism, we have to keep converting. We still have to track energy flows, any you know, manufacturing system, any factories still going to have to do that to make sure that the processes, the technical processes are working correctly. Otherwise, it'll fail as a bit is an industrial project. But what the technocracy movement is saying, what I'm saying, is that with an energy-based system of economics, we do that. And so the efficiency angle and the better allocation of resources, right? Because if you're energy inefficient, you collapse, right? As Taner says, a low energy state is collapse. That's going to happen no matter what. So the goal is, do you build an economic system that puts that as far away in the future as possible or not?
So, I mean, I guess a lot of my conceptual difficulty with this would be, how would this actually work in practice? Because a lot of the, you know, Austrian critiques of communism, right, were built on getting around the problem, or the problem that socialism has in general, with two specific areas. There's the Mises's critique, which was the calculation problem, i.e., in the absence of money markets, in the absence of prices, how do you calculate input costs? Okay, which is a kind of technical economics paper he wrote in the 1920s. And then later, F.A. Hayek had a slightly different articulation, which he called the knowledge problem. And the knowledge problem was, look, even if you had perfect information, even if you solved Mises's calculation problem with perfect information, prices still contain, right? They still contain things that you can't possibly know about. You know, for example, I don't know, let's say there's been a flood in a coffee growing country in Colombia. Let's say in Colombia there was a massive fire and it burnt down all the coffee plantations. You, as the punter at the end of the line, would only need the price information that the price of coffee has gone up to know that something's up. And if it reaches a threshold beyond a certain limit, you can switch to tea rather than coffee, let's say. And this price signal contains all sorts of other information in there that you don't actually need to know, because the price is enough to convey that. If you have an energy-based economics, how do you, to finish the thought, this is ultimately the reason why you need money markets and prices, price signals as expressed in monetary exchange, according to the Austrians. If you say, well, the basis of our system is now not going to be price signals and money markets, but instead energy, how do you not then fall into all of the problems that the Mises and the Hayek say that socialism would have, right? Do you not run into the calculation problem, the knowledge problem, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Right. Okay. So I have thought about the knowledge problem on this particular question. And when I was first exposed to the idea of energy economics through the Zeitgeist series of films in the early 2010s, if anybody remembers that, I was thinking about that too. So the ultimate, there's an assumption in the calculation problem, which is that the socialists, unlike, say, the capitalists, can quantify and measure something that is relevant to the distribution of goods in an economy. In the case of the calculation problem, it's price signals. But you see, we can also measure energy, right? A joule is a well-known defined unit of measure, and every productive process has joules put in and joules coming out. That can be measured. And unlike a price signal, now, granted, I'm not going to give the whole gold debate here, but you can't short a joule, unlike a dollar or some floating currency exchange, because in part that's based on the perception that people have that the currency is worth. So even though you can measure it, it's not certain what its value is at any given moment. Whereas with a jewel, it is. It is certain. It's not up to debate. You could have scientists from China, Russia, South Africa, Argentina, and the United States all measure it, and they're all going to say, yeah, that's a jewel. That's exactly how much it's worth at that time. You don't get that level of uniformity with a cash exchange. And so how do you then use that to correlate to the distribution of goods? Well, if you have a way of measuring energy flows within a nation or a continent, and then you overlay on top of it Tainter's idea of collapse, moving from a high energy state to a low energy state. A low energy state is economic scarcity by definition. And so what you can do then is you can have individuals who measure the energy states in a given country. And as an energy state approaches the point at which it runs the risk of going below greater than one on the euro exchange, then you realize that you have a scarcity present, and therefore energy needs to be put into that system to keep it going.
How would this actually work in practice, Todd? I mean, the reason that Austrian Econ back in the day made sense to me was always by trying to bring it back to a real physical good, okay? Let's say the production of a cake, right? Or the production of a child's toy or something like this. Now, if I'm trying to backwards engineer the supply chain for the manufacture of a cake using the Austrian method, it's pretty easy to do that. And they have this kind of inductive way of reasoning backwards from the consumer price point, backwards to the input costs, backwards up all the way up to the top of the supply chain, right? Until you can kind of map all the supply chain up using that. It's called Menger's method of imputation, right? From the subjective theory of value. How would you map the production of a cake using the feng shui energy or joules measuring technique? Lay it out for me and see if I can follow.
Yeah. So what you would do is, and this, of course, there's an important caveat, given the efficiency of the tools you have at any level of material development, there's going to be a average cost of energy that goes into making that cake. Now you could measure it for the production of that cake. Maybe it's a mom baking a cake at home for her kid's birthday party, or maybe it's mass production for an industrial process. Either way, in either case, see, we don't currently do this, right? All of our bean counters and wonks measure cash flows. But what would happen if we had a society in which those people were instead engineers that were measuring energy flows? And so then what you would do, and you can quantify all this because we know what, you know, the value of a joule is and megajoules and all this other things. And then what you would do is you'd say, well, okay, we have a best guess for the current level of energy present in our system. And the thing that we want to do costs this much energy. Now, how much of the energy within the system that we're operating do we want to devote to the production of this good? And then, of course, if we produce it at scale, the unit cost of energy will presumably go down. I don't know if it works exactly the same way for prices. This is still what I would say meta-economic. And of course, the technocrat movement didn't really get beyond the 40s. And so the idea would be then you map the amount of energy that goes into a process can be measured. Now, if it's a non-commercial process, so it's a process of production on a factory floor that is like before the product goes to sale, the engineer that or the engineers that watch over this aren't necessarily concerned about the price exchange rate. That's the factory owner's concern. Their concern is to make sure that just that the energy going into the system doesn't fall outside or below the parameters they need to keep the system going. And I'm saying we just take that idea and we just scale it up.
I'm still having conceptual trouble picturing this, Todd, right? Because I can see how you might factor in energy inputs to the cake. Okay. This is the energy it takes to sow the wheat, the energy it takes to mill the flour, the energy it takes to transport the flour to the factory, the energy it takes to put together the machines that are going to knead the dough right, the whatever it is, the transport of the finished article to the retail outlet, even the energy it takes to process the, you know, when you in the supermarket where you put the cake over the little reader thing, all of that, you could make an energy calculation, right? A per unit input cost of the cake. What I'm struggling to see is what is the energy output at the end of the line. You see, the price signal in classic economics, in Austrian economics, is an expression of the level of desire of that mother or of that individual to eat a cake or to make a cake or whatever it is, okay? So the price is just an expression of something else, desire to eat cake in this case. Could you express that as an energy factor? And I'm pretty sure that the energy that you get from eating a cake, right, whether you measure it in kilocalories or whatever else, or joules, is not gonna add up to the factor inputs that it made to making that cake in the first place. It's just not gonna make any, like, it's what I'm saying is, I can see you doing all these calculations and being like, why does anybody ever eat a cake? Because it's irrational.
Well, okay, so I think the important thing here is that when you look at what prices signal and what measuring energy for the sake of determining the EROI measures, they're ultimately two different things. Because if you are in an energy sink, your desire to eat food doesn't matter. You are going to die because you're in an energy sink. So ultimately, even if the price signal, maybe this person does want to spend $100 to buy, you know, a gold plate of pizza, whatever, that person's not going to make it. It doesn't matter, right? This is a higher order reality that's imposing itself on the price system. The price system is built on this, not the other way around. And so what I'm saying is, yeah, that might actually lead to vast restructuring of what's produced and what's consumed. But let's say, what is the capitalist, the libertarian wants to say the basic unit of economic activity is the profit motive and the price signal, right? Because the argument is, well, in a socialist country, how would you make anything if nobody's paid for it, right? Ultimately, that's not true. The ultimate foundation for all economic activity is energy. So let's imagine a girl in a frontier setting who milks a cow. She's able to milk enough calories for both herself and the rest of her family to consume to keep doing the work the next day. She's not paid to do this. In fact, you know, she's a child. The point is, she does this because there are energy demands that her family has, that her body has, that milking the cow satisfies. If it didn't satisfy it, she wouldn't be doing it, and nor would her parents make her do it. And they would cease to exist if it didn't. And so ultimately, the most basic unit of economic action is the fact that we are thermodynamic systems that need to consume energy to keep running. And of course, you could have an economic system completely detached from the cash or price system, and it still works. You could, you know, you go to the, you could scale that girl milking a cow up to the Inca Empire. They were essentially planned economy. And so the point that I'm saying is this, the meta economics part is to teach us to rethink what is the basic unit of economics. Why do we produce and consume?
So sorry to get all autistic here, right? But by the very nature of this, you kind of have to be, especially if you're going to claim the system is scientific, right? How do you calculate the energy output of the girl milking the cow? Right, I can understand calculating the input costs, right, or the inputs. How do you calculate the energy output, right, of the manufacturer of the milk? Like, i.e., she makes that milk, she distributes it to her family. Let's just stick with this human scale thing. What do you estimate it? Do you have a way of, like, do you measure the calories? Do you say, well, okay, if these people didn't have access to this milk, they would die as an absolute, right? And therefore, having this milk facilitates all of the things that they're able to produce, in which case it's a pretty complex calculation. Or do you not bother with it? Do you not bother trying to calculate the energy output? Do you see what I'm trying to get at here? Because this figure, that the output, the the bit at the consumer contact point is the bit that economics focuses on as a price signal. You're saying that there's something that comes before that and we can focus on this. And I'm asking how, like, what does it actually look like at the point of contact between milk that this girl is producing and all of the people who have it? What's the energy output? Yeah, go on.
Well, ultimately, and this principle was first used to describe predation in the animal kingdom. You don't need to measure it on one level, because animals and then pre-scientific humans couldn't and can't and didn't. And they just learned to conform. That's why I use feng shui. That was a poetic gut rule of thumb application of this principle. Now, of course, that has limits. You can't do what I'm envisioning just with that. But I mean, if you have, so our bean counters are measuring cash flow prices, and that's where all the money's at. That's how you got the stock, the crisis in housing in 2007 and 2008. All of this stuff has a built-in system of people that are constantly measuring these things, paid to measure these things, paid to present these things, all of that. Now, we don't have a parallel system for measuring energy. So what I would envision is that there would be engineers who measure all the energy in the system, and then they would say, okay, you know, this is the amount of joules. So what you might have is, say, like in K-12 education, you might have a spreadsheet or a poster where you have a car, a cake, a house, and it would have like a joules, average joules cost of production underneath it. And then all these kids would then be like, oh, okay, so this is like the average joules cost to build it in this energy system. Now, of course, for finer levels of precision and granularity at different, say, states in the union, for example, you would have more precise tools of measurement, more precise individuals doing that. And then they would be working in tandem with the producers and the distributors in order to do this. And of course, how would you track price and cost of joules? Well, what was proposed with the technocracy movement was that you'd have a certificate denominated in joules. And then it would be like, okay, well, that's what you were paid for this week. And now this is the joules cost of a car. So now you can go buy that car.
One of the other conceptual difficulties that I'm having is that obviously in the price system, the constraining factor is the total number of dollars in the system overall. Okay. And there is a little bit of complexity because there is dollars within the USA and there's dollars outside of the USA. Okay. Energy system, I mean, in theory, the total amount of energy is constant because energy cannot be created. Is that correct?
Well, in the universe, energy can either be created or destroyed, but that's the entire universe. We're just talking about like a given country here.
Right. So, and this is where I'm coming to. My understanding is that in the actual energy market is kind of done on a what you need basis, right? So like, for example, Britain, where I'm sitting now, has an energy grid. Whatever the capacity of that grid is what it is. But there is, I don't know, there are different peak times for when energy is required. For example, in the winter, people need more heating, or at nighttime, people need to put their lights on. So there are different spikes, right, in the energy grid. And sometimes if it ever risks going over whatever the current native capacity is, we simply import the excess from France or from Germany or from some other country, so that it is constantly on. Like, there's never a moment where it even risks being over capacity because the energy is coming in from somewhere else. Okay. The system you're talking about surely would still have something like this built in, which then means that it's quite difficult to do per nation or per country calculations because everybody's looking at the entire energy grid all the time, are they not?
Well, I would argue that since you know, again, with my earlier representation of scientists from all over the world being able to measure what a joule is, and agreeing on what the value of that measurement is, unlike, say, currency, which is why you can short currency, this actually would solve a lot of those problems, because you can't short a joule. The value of that unit is not determined by the perception of the animal spirits. So the question then becomes, if they're all looking for, see, I think we need to step back here, because we're all looking at the spyglass from the opposite end. See, physics comes first, then prices. Capitalism says prices come first, then physics. So everything we do is looking at it through the glass darkly, looking at it through the spyglass backwards. So a lot of things that people do, they wouldn't be doing if they understood, well, actually, I can't in the long run be doing this anyhow. And furthermore, the inefficiencies of the capitalist system build in inefficiencies at the level of consumption. Again, let's go back to distribution. We all know that the most efficient way to distribute a good, whether it's human or some consumer commodity, is mass transit, railroad. We all know this. And yet, in the United States, after 1945, we built cars and trucks. Well, in the case of cars, it's obvious. You can make a lot of money selling replacement repair parts. You can make a lot of money selling different models in a way that you can't monetize a train. And then mass transit in the city would have been like trolleys, and then people would have, I'm not saying there wouldn't have been any cars at all, but they wouldn't have been as predominant as they would be now. And if we have a society like that, as a totally different consumption schema. And then furthermore, a lot of the punch of the Mises' price argument, you know, how do you determine what to produce? Well, most of what's produced in a modern consumer economy is admitted to be junk. In Paul Mazur's American Prosperity, 1920, in order to avoid the overproduction, they just produce stuff people don't need and convince them that they need to buy it. Once you just get rid of all that stuff, because you have a totally different economic system, you have far fewer outputs to concern yourself with.
But not, you see, how can I put this? You're very quickly going to get to, I'm just trying to foresee the objections people will have in the first place, right? Which is that, okay, you're going to replace, you're going to bring in this energy system, but the engineers are quickly going to figure out that lots of things are inefficient and lots of things only exist because people enjoy them. Like me smoking the cigar, for example, or somebody eating a cake, for example, or, I mean, it's hard to justify any of these things from an energy point of view, right? You can justify the train, or you can justify the lady doing the milking, but lots and lots and lots of things that we do are kind of pointless from the pure view of utility, right? Or from an energy point of view, they're just pointless. And yet, many of these things are the things that kind of give us happiness as humans. They fulfill some irrational desire that we have. And that would be that, like, that is the ultimate Austrian Trump argument. Like, this is the thing. It's like, well, you're actually satisfying individual wants, even if those things don't make any sense. People want them, right? And there are so many of those things. It's, you know, Nintendo Switch, for example, or I don't know, like, you name it. So many things in the cold light of day can't really be justified from the point of view of efficiency or the point of view of rationality, and yet they make our lives, you know, easier. They make the eternal struggle in life easier to get through. Something like this. How do you respond to these sorts of arguments?
Well, I would argue that efficiency here needs to be understood within its proper domain. So when we talk about a production system that is efficient or inefficient, we're not usually talking about what it produces. We're talking about how it produces what it produces. So, for example, when there was the common comparison between the United States and the Soviet Union in comparison of industrial production, and then it was claimed the Soviet model of production was inefficient, it wasn't because of what the Soviets were producing necessarily. It was when you compare the product, the mechanism of production in the West to the mechanism of production in the East, the mechanism of production in the West was superior. Now, that was often also bundled with a criticism of shoddy Soviet product, but that wasn't the reason. They weren't inefficient because they were producing shoddy products. They were inefficient because of the means of allocating and distributing resources. And as I said, an energy system would be by definition the most efficient because economic activity of all kinds fundamentally rests on a physics and thermodynamic flows. And so once you measure that, you have a mechanism to measure that, and then you build production systems that avoid, you know, overproduction, I guess, without selling useless junk, then you would be efficient. Now then, as to determining what is produced and why, well, the ultimate ceiling is the energy in the system. If you go into an energy sink, you have no more energy to produce. So ultimately, in the same way that, in an analogous way that financiers are trying to push off a financial collapse, like the 1929 stock market collapse, these engineering economists would try to put off the collapse of going into a low energy state. And of course, they would come up with ways and means of doing that that we can't really even envision yet because such an infrastructure doesn't even exist. But also the idea then that within a, you're going to get to a point, and this was the problem of overproduction, you're going to get to a point where all the basic material needs are met with advanced modern production systems. And so you could actually meet all of the baseline human needs really easily, you know, compared to previous centuries. So that would have a larger energy data bank, if you will, for investment. And so I actually think that would allow for more creative, non strictly speaking utilitarian enterprises. And then why would you do this? Because it's the only way you get innovation. You can't get innovation through quarterly profits or through, you know, putting people under the gun. You have to create ecosystems and environments where people can develop the kinds of outlooks on life and behavior that allows them to be innovative, which allows this entire process to continue.
But I mean, the principle, one of the prime parts of Mises' argument is that even if you imagine that the central controller has perfect information, okay, people's tastes then change, right? So let's say you have perfect data right now, and you backwards engineer the entire production chain to produce, I don't know, a particular type of lady's shoe or something like this, okay? What happens when that shoe, due to the tastes of individuals out there and taste makers and fashion and so on, changes in 18 months' time, and you can now not work out how many people want the new shoe because you don't have, like, the data, like, it's changed again, okay? So this is actually a problem the Soviet Union genuinely faced. We've talked before, Stalin, you know, he was going on heavy industry. He said, well, look, forget all this consumer stuff. You get one boot. Literally, you get one style of boot. And many people in the Soviet Union actually made their own clothes still. Okay. Then Khrushchev came along and said, look, well, we're getting outflanked by the Americans. We need to bring in consumer choice. But they had this issue where they could never actually keep up with consumer choice. So this is like a real life calculation problem that the Soviet Union faced. How does the energy system actually, at the point that people want them, figure out that people want this thing and then get it in front of them? Do you see the issue? Yeah. Or is this, in this kind of future world, are people not going to have these kind of fashion tastes or, you know, need for this style of shoe or that style of jacket or whatever else it is?
Well, I would begin by saying that I actually do think there would be much less demand for such things because one, we are told why these things exist. They exist to avoid the problem of overproduction, and through psychological manipulation, these people get us to buy stuff we don't technically need, because we need to make a distinction between needs, things that we must consume or have in order to live, otherwise we just wouldn't, such as food, and drink. And then what we might call wants, things that would be nice to have, but we won't perish if we don't get it. Now, it's in that area where the capitalists made the pivot. And of course, how do they? Well, they manufacture consent. I mean, we've all seen Chomsky. This isn't like people have these organic latent tendencies floating around in the id that are just magically channeled through the oracle of, capitalism. No, it's just focus groups. They go out there. They say, hey, if we had this thing, Adam Curtis, your guy, right? He did a whole bunch of videos on the focus group. They're like, if you had this thing, would you use it? And they're like, wow, I never even thought of this thing before. But yeah, maybe I would use it if I had it. I mean, in a court case, that's called prejudicing asking the leading question. You're asking the leading question, then you act like you're an oracle who somehow discerned the latent id properties of your consumer. So I think that whole mechanism does exist within the capitalist system and probably wouldn't with it.
What if let's just say a lady wants a particular pink shoe, right? So a pink shoe. The actual specifics of that shoe maybe are manufactured. Maybe, that it's artificial, her desire for this particular shoe. But could we not take a step back and say, well, people are like this, though, and that in the moment, wherever it is, the desire for that thing that is desirable just for that fleeting moment does actually give meaning, purpose, happiness, fulfillment to that individual who's getting their desire to, I don't know what it is, fit in, wear the latest fashion. You understand what I'm saying, right? Is that if you zoom out enough, maybe this, not this shoe, not that shoe, but something. This seems to be an expression of what people are like. Hence, there's always been fashion.
Well, there's always been fashion amongst the upper classes who have enough leisure and extra wealth to spend it on. But the point is, when we look at the United States and also specifically what was proposed by the technocracy movement, it's not centrally planned in the sense of you have a Soviet board of directors who says we're going to make 100,000 shoes this year or whatever. Its energy is the unit of exchange. It replaces the price system. So I would still envision, say a guy who makes shoes out of his house, old school, or maybe a small local company that makes shoes. The difference would be though that their inputs to production would be much more precise with regards to the energy inputs. And of course, with a Pareto distribution, it's not like a producer has an infinite variety of potential options to cater to. One, he doesn't, 20% of his customers or 80% of his business. And second of all, he just doesn't have even the financial resources to cater to a potentially infinite amount of taste. There's still going to be a limiting factor. And what I'm saying is even today, that limiting factor is physics. We just pretend that it's not. What I'm saying is if we built a system in which we self-consciously built it in the light of that knowledge, a lot of things would be more efficient, it would work better, and people would be happier.
How do you determine how much energy each person has to spend? Because presumably, if you were replacing the price system, each individual's got an energy budget that they can allocate, right? So maybe I can spend it on shoes or cakes or whatever else, but it's up to me to use it, right? How do you work that out? And as a related question, how do you stop the age-old problem? This is the capitalism's problem, really, of the runaway leader accumulating huge amounts of energy for themselves and becoming an energy monopolist and holding the rest of society to ransom, becoming an energy oligarchy, something like this.
Yeah, well, to the extent that, so there's only really been two groups that have tried to answer this particular question within the energy-based economy movement. There was the original technocrats, then there was in the 70s and 80s and 90s, a guy named Jacques Fresco of the Vetus Project. None of them, since both of these movements are more or less moribund, they didn't really answer that problem. But I think for starters, and this is how maybe where this might be attractive to the Marxists in your audience, I think this would avoid the problem of exploitation. the amount of energy that any given worker put in while on the clock of production at whatever job he was at would be his salary in energy certificates. So let's say you worked, you know, 2 weeks, what, you know, you worked a month and you worked, say, part-time, 48 hours each day, you know, for, so then you add all that up, or sorry, each 2 week period. And so then what you have is that's what you get paid in. You get paid in the energy that you put into the system. And that's your energy certificate. And then that you can then go spend that on other things. It must also be kept in mind that the technocrats were the first people to come up with universal basic income. They were advocating this in 1920. And so that's another thing that you might also consider. So for like, you know, there's a universal basic income, then on top of whatever you would put in. So if you look at an industrial process, and this is where I think the Marxists and the capitalists run into trouble. The total energy output is of a factory is based on the machines, not the actual people putting the energy in. Now, that means, though, that there's a huge amount of value coming out the back end that was not put in by the worker. Now, some of that might be exploitation. But, you know, again, the work done, work is the product of force and distance. The work done was the machine. So the worker didn't actually do all of that work. So you have a, so you have the worker machine energy system, and the energy output, the product output, the work output is massively the machine, like 95% the machine. And the work person puts in maybe like 5%. Okay, well, from a Marxist point of view, that's exploitation. And some of it might be. But this is where it gets tricky, because the work, certainly the work wasn't being done by the capitalist, but most of the work was being done by the machine. But do you pay the machine? No, that doesn't really make sense. That doesn't make a lot of sense. And it's from that insight that you get the UBI. It's like, well, look, I mean, most of the productive value, energy-based, is coming from these machines. And in the current capitalist system, it doesn't come back down to the workers. It just goes, just keeps going up. And that's the broader Marxist critique.
Well, one of the, I mean, again, this is where I struggle to leave behind my Austrian, I guess, grounding, or, you know, I wrote a whole book on this back in the day. One of the very underexplored areas in economic theory that the Austrians are particularly keen on is cost. And in fact, a whole book was written on cost by, I think it was that guy Buchanan. I think it was Buchanan, James Buchanan. And he says, like, look, everybody in economics understands the notion of an opportunity cost, okay? And yet, in classical economics, they've got this box called cost. But actually, because value is subjective, all costs are always already foregone. And all costs are opportunity costs, okay? Foregone. That is, if I spend, let's say this microphone is an input cost for me to run this show, the price I pay for this microphone is foregone and is lost forever. I cannot say that the cost of this microphone is embedded in some way in the output of this show. It is always already gone already. Okay. The conceptual difficulty I'm having with understanding this answer that you gave me with the energy, right? The energy input is your wage, essentially. You know, the energy that you've put into whatever this process is the amount that then you get to spend elsewhere. The trouble is that in exactly the same way, that energy is foregone. It's not like it's magically, I mean, there was an industrial process that went into making this pad of paper, but it's not like the energy just stays in here imbued. It's gone. It's for, like the truck that transported it here, the energy that was used and the fuel that was burned, it's gone already. So how can you say that? How can you use this to calculate anything? Because it's gone. How do you answer this question?
Well, I mean, isn't that what the libertarians say that the dollar is supposed to do? It measures that. But that's gone as well, right? Because I spent it.
Well, no. See, what the Austrians say is whatever the money costs of the inputs are, that's at the point, that is just a kind of forward planning, speculative enterprise on the part of the entrepreneur. Okay. I explain all this in Foundations of Economics, if anybody's interested in this. It's kind of tedious, but it's also interesting because these are things nobody ever talks about. So when, let's say our cake baker, right, our cake manufacturer, he is making a forward bet that people are going to buy this cake at this price point. And then he backwards plans the input cost based on his projected sales at the output. However, at the point of the sale of that cake, whatever input costs have gone into it, let's say he's bought the flour, the ovens, and all the other, you know, the capital equipment and staff, all that money he's paid for the manufacture of that cake is gone. He can't turn around to the customer and say, oh, you don't understand how much the oven cost. You don't understand how much I had to pay that guy. The customer doesn't care. The customer's like, no, I want this cake at this price point here. All the rest of it, don't give me a sob story. I want it for $1 or wherever it happens to be. If that entrepreneur is not able to sell that cake for $1 and he has to slash his price to 50 cents, say, and he ends up making a loss on the cake, no amount of his costs can, no amount of him citing the costs can recover that because it's already gone. Do you understand? It's not, what they're saying is that the input costs aren't actually reflected at the price at the point of sale.
Yeah, but I'm talking about wages. I'm talking about what the person is paid for the work that they did during that shift on the factory floor. And so I don't see how that connects to the price point of a sale.
Well, because the wage that you pay that dude, okay, is a forward bet from the point of view of the entrepreneur. It's a forward bet based on a speculative chance to get a return of investment. But the actual wage he gets from the point of view of the business is foregone. It's gone. That wage is gone. Okay. He takes the wage now because he's willing to take money today rather than take the risk of the entrepreneur. Okay. He just said, well, I'll guarantee this $5 an hour, whatever I'm getting paid in exchange for, okay, a predictable planning horizon, something like this. This is what Bomber-Virk talks about. The point is that, how can I put this? The fact that he's done that work is neither here nor there at the point at which the cake is sold. So therefore, the price that he's getting, I mean, it will matter in so much as if the entrepreneur continues to make a loss, he will eventually have to cut that job or close down, in which case the job disappears. Okay. But for the purposes of calculation, the purposes of actually working out the production costs and so on, it doesn't actually, you can't produce the price of the cake simply through knowledge of the input costs, because the price of the cake is not being determined by the input cost. It's being determined by the subjective valuations of the consumer at the end of the line. And in fact, the worker's wage is backwardsly imputed from the total sales projected at the end of the line. And then you discount it based on that. This is a very difficult thing to explain, right? But do you understand what I'm saying here?
Yeah, so there's a lot of points we could go at this, but I guess what I'll just say is that this Robinson Crusoe version of the consumer doesn't exist. This consumer has their tastes calibrated and created, manufactured by, as Noam Chomsky pointed out, by these groups of people. They're not acting in the dark like they pretend to be. I mean, maybe if you're a small business owner, you are. But if you're the bourgeoisie, you're not acting in the dark. It's like what Pink Floyd said in their song, "We told you what to dream." Okay, like they're not surprised that you want this. They told you to want it, and then they drummed it up with campaigns, and then you want it. Now the other thing is, even if you overlay the cash system on top of all of this, if energy is leaving the system, you won't be able to produce. That will shut down your factory just as surely as investments drying up. This is a more fundamental system. Because, and here's what I'm going to end with. All of this financialization system has to be actively constructed and imposed in secret on the American people. Physics just is. Nobody has to impose it. It just is. I'm saying let's look at what is and the dynamic system that we are engaging in to have economic production ought not to be the financial system of the bourgeoisie, but ought to be the system of physics, which still governs them too. They just like to pretend that it doesn't.
Very interesting, Todd. Well, people can kind of let us know what you think here. Maybe I just have a failure of imagination, Todd. All right. But I still struggle, even though I understand what you're saying and Noam Chomsky and the manufacture of content and so on and so forth, that there are these fine-tuned aspects buried deep in Austrian theory that I struggle to see how you get beyond, because it is true, right? It is true that if the product at the end of the line cannot be sold, the price will be slashed, which shows that the retail price is purely speculative in the end analysis, i.e. not every good is sold at that price. That's what they hope to sell it for. But the fact that things are reduced, half price, 75%, clearance sales and so on, shows that actually the price can move. Because of that, I then struggle to see how the end point is being projected forward by the manufacturer rather than what the consumer at the end of the line is willing to pay. It may take further unpacking, on this economics front. Very interesting, though, and very interesting to hear somebody think so far outside of the box when it comes to this. Where can people find you again?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at PLF Podcast, and you can follow me on YouTube, Praise of Folly Podcast.
And as I mentioned at the start, there is a course now available at the University of Buckingham. My buddy Eric Kaufman has made this available, and I'm just got a short video I'm going to play before we wrap up here.
The ideology of our universities and many other institutions can accurately be described as woke. Woke is not an epithet, but used properly describes the dominant cultural left belief system of Western institutions. Have you ever wondered how woke came about, who believes in it, and why? Or how the culture war between woke and anti-woke forces is redefining society and politics? Well, there's good news. I've developed a 15-week online course on woke at the University of Buckingham, which is open to the global public, the first of its kind in the world. The course is not assessed, but is focused instead on deepening your understanding of woke. I offer a rigorous objective analysis of this phenomenon, similar to the way I would for fascism, communism, or any other ideology. I've studied the cultural left since the mid-1990s, and I'm ideally placed to help you understand woke. Sign up today using the attached link.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.